Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So it's the spring equinox, is it? Today? My brother's birthday? So some reflections on the Dhamma. Contemplating this idea of being fully conscious, fully awake, present. It's a simple enough idea. And it's something that we train in our practice. So it's not a very complicated idea, or it's not really an esoteric experience. When I ask you just to listen and bring your mind to a sense of presence and receptivity, it's kind of language. So it's not secret. It's not some great insight that you don't have. It's always there. But to actually sustain that, say just in a meditation for 45 minutes, without falling asleep, without reacting to pain, without thinking about the future, without thinking about the past, or knowing thoughts better, knowing thoughts of past and future, something right here, rather than getting caught up and getting kidnapped, that's more difficult. The way that this teaching talks about human happiness and human suffering, it basically says that the problem is ignorance, or not seeing clearly the way things are, or not knowing the way things are. And last weekend I was looking up at the lovely sky and no clouds just before going to sleep on Saturday night. And the Big Dipper, the handle of the Big Dipper was pointing to my right. And then when I woke up in the morning, it was pointing to my left, relative to me. And so it looked like the sky was moving. So it looked like the Big Dipper had moved from right to left. But Galileo showed us that, and others have showed us that it's not true. So I kind of went through that same exercise one goes through in high school or whenever. Okay, how is this working? Which way is the world spinning? What's happening? Where am I? Where's that? Where's the North Star? And I just went through that mental exercise that I've been through many times, really. So is it counterclockwise or is it clockwise? Which way? And then I get a feeling for it. And okay, that's what's happening. In a sense, that's what we're doing with our own conscious experience, is that as long as we function from some form of misunderstanding or wrong seeing or ignorance, avijja, then we interpret things from that avijja, from that misunderstanding. And as long as we interpret things not according to nature, then we face the consequences of that. And this teaching is just really pointing to the way things are. It's not something that we can't see ourselves. So in meditation, we're trying to do something where we remain free from ignorance for the span of the meditation. We remain clear in our understanding of the way things are for, say, here, 45 minutes. So ignorance isn't simply a lack of information, it's a kind of problem that arises constantly. So if I'm meditating and I make an intention to meditate and to be with whatever object I want to meditate with, and then I start planning about next week, that's a form of ignorance, because I haven't chosen to plan. I haven't done that deliberately, but the sense of self arises and the future arises and a whole world arises and I'm caught up in thinking. And that's avijja. That's not really knowing the way things are. And then a point comes in that minor delusion where I awaken. I notice, oh, I'm planning, or there is planning. And the movement from being the person who is now in the future to the awakening of this as a thought, that's vijja, that's knowledge. And that's insight. They say, that's just a thought, or that's a mood. So awakening isn't just one final moment somewhere in the future where suddenly one awakens and everything is finished. Awakening can be seen as something that's ongoing. And we see that in meditation, don't we? Where we sit down and we try to meditate and then get sleepy. And in sleep, mind just goes into dreamy states, and that's delusion. It's not evil or it's not immoral to fall asleep during meditation or to plan one's life during meditation or to resent the neighbor. It's not immoral in that sense, but it's still delusion because one isn't fully awake to the way things are. One isn't fully conscious. And so what happens with delusion is that attention gets caught up with these various self scenarios through foggy, dreamy states, through planning, through worrying or whatever, and this constant arising of a sense of self through these things is delusion. And then the awakening to that, you say, oh, that's just a thought. Or that's just a mood which is driving these thoughts. That's knowledge, clarity, on-off switch, arising and ceasing. So that's not that difficult, really. Like as an insight, that's not far away. We've all had it many times. And we're trying to actually strengthen that insight, that constant insight, so that the delusion of self and all the storylines and the narratives that we get caught up into, that no longer kidnaps us, that no longer deludes us. So the moods may come up and those thought formations may begin to kind of coalesce or take formation, but the strength of vijja, the strength of awareness, the strength of knowing this is just an object, surmounts all that, is stronger than that. So we're no longer dominated by these habitual forces that we tend to suffer from if we're not awake, if we're not aware. So that's simple enough. So awakeness isn't something that you get through greed, right? It's not something you get through aversion. It's not something that it just happens. I mean, you have to make intention. But it's not the intention to get rid of or become, it's the intention to know. This is it. It's like just like this. And to do that and to hold that and to sustain that is one of the aspects of both meditation and just daily life practice. And one can't emphasize that enough, the importance of that, and I think we all see the difficulty of that, whatever it is. So in our meditation practice, then we have to have a kind of personal integrity or a sense of inquiry into how does the sense of self kidnap me? How does the sense of self grab attention? What is it about the makeup of this being, of these mental states that gets so trapped by this? Why do I always fall asleep in meditation? Or why do I always go to anxious states about the future? Or why, whatever. And how can I awaken that? And then as, and how can I train my mind to not believe in that? How can I train my capacity to pay attention, not to get deluded by that? That's ongoing work, but it's very rewarding, because what we're doing is we're no longer emphasizing the mood of the mind. We're no longer emphasizing the sense of self. We're no longer emphasizing any external object. What we're emphasizing as important is that clarity of presence. We're making that important rather than the object. When we get caught up with thinking and planning and worrying and falling asleep and so on, attention is emphasizing an object. So if you look at sleepiness in meditation, the whole energy system is now on some kind of a dreamy state, and that's an object. So to know a dreamy state or a foggy state or a sleepy state as an object, that takes vitality. It takes a certain kind of vitality. In meditation, we sometimes talk about emphasizing two aspects, calm and vitality. You say, like yesterday at the Quaker house, there was a chap who was new to the meditation, and he got himself a chair against the wall and got really comfortable. And within, it must have been, you know, it was only 5 minutes into the meditation, he was full bore snoring. You know, it was like this. And I woke him up and all that. But you could see his idea of sitting was being comfortable. You could just get in there. And he had no experience in meditation. So we're not trying to get comfortable. Like if you develop meditation to fall asleep, that's not a good idea. Some people do that. They develop breath meditation so they can fall asleep better. You don't want to do that. Because breath meditation or whatever meditation you do, there has to be vitality and calmness. You want both of those, vitality and calmness. So you look at your own efforts that you make. How do you bring vitality, brightness, presence, clarity? How do you bring that into consciousness? But how do you keep it calm? Steady. So, like working with the breath, you can see that if the breath become, if you are in a very kind of passive state of mind, and you fall asleep easily, the breath, the subtlety of the breath, is probably not good, because you're not aware. So you do different things. So you contemplate. Okay, this is what's happening in this meditation. What do I need to do? That's the creativity of the meditative process. What do I need to do? What, obviously, I need to do something more coarse, or more, you know, how to bring vitality. I need to put more energy into the posture. I need to adjust the breathing, make it deeper, and so on. On the other hand, if the meditation, I just try so hard, and the clock doesn't move, and I'm kind of full of energy, I know I'm there. Like in sleepiness, you don't know you're there until someone kicks you. And in dullness, you know, in restlessness, you know you're there, and the clock won't move. And then you have to do something else, don't you? You have to, okay, just calm down. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. Relax the posture. And this is right thinking. This kind of thinking is not just obsessed thinking or habitual thinking or worry thinking or dull thinking. It's actually right thoughts, sammasankappa. So we talk about right understanding and right thought, samadhiti, samasankappa. Right understanding, in some ways, is to know this is the way it is now. That's a kind of not. It's a kind of understanding of presence, and then the understanding that that's what's important. Just this knowing of the way things are now, and then right thought is. These are ways to talk about it. They're not absolute ways to talk about it. But so then right thought can also be, so how can I maintain that? So then as my mind, say, starts to become anxious about something in the future, and the self-thought is very strong in that anxiety, say, okay, what do I need to do to really just know anxiety? Anxiety feels this way. So I keep coaching myself. I keep encouraging myself with right thought. Wrong thought would be either just being lost in the thinking process, which is a big big difficulty we all have, just being continually just rabbiting on in the inner world of thought. That would be one way of wrong thinking. Or the other way of wrong thinking would be just some kind of judgment about oneself. But right thinking is more like coaching yourself, encouraging yourself in some ways. Or if you don't understand the problem, then like an inquiry. What is going on now? Why is this meditation so, why is it so difficult? Or why does it, you know, what's happening, what's going on? So the inquiry then hopefully leads to a deeper insight. There's the insight of what the awakened mind is, right? You know what that is. And then you start to get very, like personal insights around your own difficulties, the defilements of consciousness which you experience, the hindrances which you experience in meditation. And then the insights are around the same issue, really, of how to sustain awakeness. But then they're specifically around, how do I sustain awakeness around the worry mind, the planning mind, the doubting mind, the depressed mind, all these different moods that we experience. How to know those without being caught. And the bottom line is always the self view. If I feel like really maybe something is, I've had a series of mishaps maybe, little things kind of going wrong, and I get the flu, and I get, I lose this, and I lose that, and kind of just a series of negative things. That, as any impression on consciousness, is depressing, maybe. I feel kind of down. Now, that's a natural mood that we have, but then to run with that with thought is obviously delusion. That's the delusion, that's the problem. It's not the feeling of being down, that's not a problem, that's life. That comes and that goes. But the problem or the delusion or the wrong understanding is then the thinking mind, the self-thinking mind. And so the power of awareness has to be focused on just the very sense of self that arises with a strong mood. And if you do that, if you just like make that the very object of meditation, the sense of self that comes up with a strong mood, you see it keeps disappearing. The sense of self is not any fixed thing. It just keeps, it disappears. And there is simply the mood, the energy, suchness, the way things are. So this is a very good way to meditate. To meditate by noticing the sense of self arising and really just keeping attention. How does it come up? And you'll find that sense of awareness then is bigger than the sense of self. Sense of self, psychological self that comes and goes, is just simply conditioned phenomena arising and ceasing. And that which knows it is deeper, is more profound. It's not deluded by that. And so the moods and energies which delude us the most are the ones that trigger off the strongest sense of self. You know, if you feel really jealous towards someone, or you feel really really self-critical. Or you really want something, or you really want to get rid of something, or you're really afraid of something happen, the stronger the mood, the stronger the sense of self, right? And that'll energize it. So what to do with that? Well, the mood is the mood, but the sense of self, that you can know. You can know that as an object. And when you know the sense of self as an object, then that's that original insight, the awake mind. So knowing sense of self as an object rather than being sense of self. And we all see that, don't we? We're kind of walking along the street and fantasizing about something and being anywhere but on the street, and there's a red light. And we wake up. And to note that, to note, now this is the awake mind, presence, and make that really kind of valuable in your life and important, rather than just tripping off to the next thought and to the next thought. So thinking is an important thing to both use skillfully, but to also know as an object, right thought as opposed to wrong thought. And so effort in our meditative life, in our contemplative life, effort is always something about this capacity to sustain awareness in the present moment. It's not to get rid of anything. It's not to become anything. Effort is to to kind of how can I maintain this present moment awareness? So if I'm in some social situation where someone's really ticking me off or making me annoyed, the temptation is to run with that annoyance and run with the thought. And then the practice, what's the effort, is sustain awareness on that. So the sense of self wants to get born and take off into self-righteousness or whatever you want. But the practice is to stay with the awareness. This is the way it feels. And that's hard practice, especially if the habits are very deluding. So we can get very deluded by things like self-righteousness. I'm right and they're wrong, or fearfulness or whatever. But always the practice comes back to, this is a strong emotion, that's right thinking, be aware, be careful, and then to know that sense of self that arises as an object. And that's non-attachment. That's what we mean by non-attachment. Non-attachment doesn't mean that you don't feel these things. These are karmically formed and conditioned into the mind. They're part of our emotional systems, all kinds of reasons. So non-attachment doesn't mean one doesn't experience these things, but the feeling that it's me and mine, the delusion of that, the believing in that, that's the problem. So right effort then is, you can see, like there are some things in consciousness which when I do, right, when I do them, they make that capacity to be aware stronger. So when I when I decide to do a regular practice of meditation and I make that a very important part of my life, that is right effort because that helps me to be more aware through my life. So there's certain things that we do in our life which help us to be present and awake. And those are the things we want to make stronger, don't we? And there's certain things in our life which we do which make us more confused or more jaded or more busy with our thoughts and all that. And those we need to adjust and drop or let go of. So mindfulness is like having both being present but also having themes which will help you to do this. So when we talk about mindfulness, right mindfulness, we'll say anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath. You keep something in mind. So in mindfulness practice, it's not what you learn to do is you learn to kind of pick up a theme or something about the present moment that helps you stay in the present moment. So when we're working with the breath, it's not so much just the breath. It's about being present, and the breath is something that's going on in the present moment. So in the kind of moods of consciousness that we experience, the kind of delusions that we get caught up into, I think the personal practice becomes one of, okay, what kind of practices could I keep in mind to help me be aware through those kind of confusing, deluding periods? So let's say I have a strong tendency towards being very critical and judgmental and averse to people. Well, then obviously, if I can keep in mind things like, may all beings be free from suffering, if I can keep that theme in mind, if I can be mindful of the practice of metta, if I keep that in mind, then when the aversions and self-criticisms and all that mode of putting life down comes into consciousness, I've got another theme which helps me to be aware of that. Or I might pick up the theme of the body, just body awareness, that I notice that my mind is always just skidding off into the future. And I really am serious about trying to stay present to the way things are. And I decide, okay, well, I'll keep the body as a frame of reference. I'll keep the body as my practice of mindfulness. So it's like a theme. It's something you pick up, which is in the present moment. The body's always here. And you get really good at that. You get really good at staying with body feelings staying with me, breath or the heart or pressure or tension or energy, whatever you want. And you get really good at that. You get mindfulness of the body. And then the other, when it starts to, the thinking mind starts to generate all this stuff, you've got a reference point. Yeah, yeah. But what is the body like? What is the body like? So mindfulness isn't just about kind of controlling yourself. It's also like having, in introducing skillful means into your daily life practice, where you pick up themes that really help you enhance your capacity to understand life and to be present. The capacity, like samadhi, the capacity to really focus, to be able to stay with a span of attention for a period of time, is something that needs to be cultivated with quite clear intention. So when you're meditating, say, and you realize that somehow samadhi, one aspect of it is that one has to somehow learn how to sustain this awareness of the way things are for spans. You can't just kind of, you know, sporadically think, oh, I'll watch my breath, and then just go into dreamy states for 45 minutes and then the bell rings and that was that. There has to be a clear intention to hold your mind in the moment with a span. And so just a simple exercise like I'll notice the breath for one out breath. What are you doing there? You're picking up the theme of the breath, but you're also making intention just to sustain that balance, like a bicycle. I'm gonna stay balanced on the bicycle from this lamppost to that lamppost. So I'm going to be with the breath for one whole in-breath. And that's the kind of determination you make, to hold attention for a span. And what prevents you from holding that attention for a span are various kinds of hindrances. You get sleepy or dull or restless or averse, or you have full of doubts, and so you're faced with those. So a 45-minute meditation is not much in life, but what it does, it cultivates all these very wholesome factors if you keep them in mind. If meditation just becomes a sort of habit where you plunk yourself down and you know just kind of hang in for the 45 minutes, then of course it's not that profitable. But to kind of see meditation, this period of meditation, as deepening all these very fundamental aspects of the liberated heart. Like right understanding. And what is right understanding? Well, this is the way it is now. It's just this way. No comment. And then you see the commentary, the judgment, just that. And then right thinking, well, like you begin to see, what kind of thoughts do you present to yourself? Are they thoughts which are encouraging? Are they thoughts according to Dhamma? Or are they just the usual gossip of an inner world that just goes on and on and on? Is that right thought? So you begin to really be more aware of the types of thinking and then cultivate right thought. Thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of compassion, thoughts which are about the Dhamma, about cause and effect. And this isn't just kind of inner analysis, it's like really kind of seeing clearly and then encouraging the mind in the right way. And then right effort, the effort to cultivate the wholesome and abandon the unwholesome. So if you've been doing, say, metta practice for some period of time, don't give it up. Don't say, oh, okay, I've got that one now. Keep it in tune. It's like keeping in shape. The meditative life is one where if you don't continually kind of work at it, the mind just very easily, unless you're very, very adept, the mind very easily goes into shoddy habits. One notices that on the retreats, people who haven't meditated for a while, they haven't done a sitting practice, they take some 2 or 3 days to get in shape, as it were. And I take my glasses off so I can't notice what's going on, because sometimes I watch people during the first 3 days of a retreat and I don't want to look. I feel guilty, actually. They kind of fall in, full of pain and so on. And part of meditation is like really just learning to be with the way things are. And that right effort that you make, you need to keep doing that. So all of us say when we started meditation, just the capacity to be with discomfort. If you remember, I can hardly remember, but I sort of vaguely remember it was quite painful. Knees hurt, my bottom hurt, and my thighs hurt, and my mind hurt. And to get to the state where you're not, you know, kind of getting tensed up about the pain, where you can just, okay, it's just pain, it's discomfort, move if you want. That takes training, doesn't it? It takes you a while to learn how to be with discomfort because one's used to comfort or whatever. So any kind of training that I've done like that, in terms of right effort, sustain that, keep that going. Those are really good qualities. You don't want to chuck those away. And then, so right effort has that aspect of both maintaining good practices that you've already done and bringing in new practices which will be beneficial, and vice versa, of abandoning practices, habits, tendencies which are unskillful and not letting new ones come in. So you're always sort of seeing, what are you doing? What are you doing with your life? And so on. And then, like in right mindfulness, really, I do like this idea of themes where you decide to pick something up that kind of keeps you engaged. It's very, very helpful. I might choose to like the end of the out breath. That's a really, really good thing to engage yourself with at committee meetings, in the bus, you know, to actually engage something like that, to understand the end of the out-breath, the tension there, whatever. Now, you can do that for a long time. You can do that for 6 months, do it for 6 years. And then, because you pick up this theme about the present moment, about your conscious experience, and you get good at it, then you have this kind of skill because you've picked up a theme. You've picked up the theme of breathing at the belly, at the end of the out-breath. Or you've picked up the theme of compassion, kindness, and you wake up every morning, you say, may I be free from suffering, may all beings be free from suffering. You do it throughout the day. You pick up a theme and you encourage that in the mind. That gives a lot of power. It's only a little thing, like initially, it's only like just the out-breath, no big deal. But then you keep doing it. So you become adept at a certain theme. You become good at it. You become proficient at it. You begin to really enjoy actually doing that because it's a place of skill. It's a place which gives good benefit and so many other things. So, right, mindfulness, when you read the themes of mindfulness, they're varied. Themes of death, themes of asupa, themes of the not beautiful, themes of the heart, themes of the breath, contemplating the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the kind of many themes that can be used to bring forth wholesome states of mind. And then, like the way samadhi is described, of course, in the text, you get very, very high descriptions of sama samadhi, where you have these states of absorption and so on. But when you also consider what sama samadhi is, when you break it down, you see it also says that, well, first of all, you have to sort out the five hindrances: dullness, restlessness, aversion, greed, and doubt. So these are ways of describing the kind of thought energies and so on that your mind gets caught up into. So learning to sustain an awake mind for five out-breaths where the hindrances don't obsess you is part of sama samadhi. And then the other things begin to come into play. You begin, as the hindrances, as you understand them, as they no longer impact you or take over consciousness, you begin to be able to use thought in a very kind of specific way. You know, just stay with an out-breath. You can just make little suggestions. And the need to make suggestions gets more and more subtle. And your whole body begins to relax, your mind begins to relax. And you're more and more just one with the present moment. And those are the factors of concentration. And as the body is happy and the mind is happy, it just begins to move on its own, sail on its own. It has its own momentum. But first of all, one has to just be with these, the dullness, the sleepiness, and all of that, and just get really good at that. So if in your meditation that you feel hot and stuffy, and you'd rather not be here, fine. This is what it feels like to rather not be here. Because that's quite important, not to just think that meditation is a comfortable experience of sweet pleasantness and niceness. Because you really learn from like uncomfortable mental states or uncomfortable physical states without hurting yourself. You really learn, okay, how can I stay awake to this and not go to self-thought? What's the challenge here? Huh? And so if you take it as a challenge, it's really neat. It's like a difficult craft or something. But if one thinks that meditation is simply, like a good meditation is pleasant 45 minutes, then there's not much maturity there. Good meditation isn't about pleasant or unpleasant, it's about awareness. So you can have a really difficult emotional, mental kind of process going through you, saying, wow, but I am aware. This is what it feels like. And that's, so it's if one is just judging things on a basis of pleasant, non-pleasant, then it's rather, I think, a shallow view of meditation. So if you have a pleasant meditation, well, that was a good meditation, but if you felt restless, that was a bad meditation. No. You're like, could I be aware of restlessness? Because quite often you'll find that, you know, you'll have difficulty with some unpleasant condition that comes up, you know, state of regret or doubt, and you just stay with it. Your thinking mind will want to go to self, you know, you stay with it. And then later on you feel quite peaceful. Now, and quite often you won't equate that. You think, oh, well, I'm peaceful now, but I wasn't peaceful then. Well, why are you peaceful now? It's because you were willing to bear with that. You're willing to bear with unpeacefulness, with difficulty or whatever, with awareness. So the quality of the experience is simply part of anicca dukkha anatta. But the awareness can know the quality as an object. Desire, craving, is that which seeks certain qualities, and that's why it's so deluding. Desire seeks the pleasant and tries to get to the unpleasant. Awareness knows the pleasant and the unpleasant. Now, this isn't to hurt yourself. Not like to, you have to sleep on a bed of nails to do this, but to realize that spectrum of consciousness which we experience from the refined to the coarse, from the beautiful to the ugly, that's just the movement of nature. But that knowing that awareness, that's the perspective of freedom, rather than the quality of the experience. So any amount of self-view that you can begin to really not believe in, just know. That arising of a whole kind of self scenario. The more you know that, the more free you are. And so the refuge is in awareness rather than in the conditions. The refuge is in knowing change rather than being sucked into the changing conditions. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayam dhammavargataya sadhu karandiramase sadhu, 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 anamodami.
Any comments or questions for anyone? Easy enough?
Twice in one day.
All right. I'm just looking at our nice machine here. Bye-bye.